Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast. As truthful as resources permit, my name's Jimmy and I voted Leave in the EU referendum in 2016.
Hello there, and my name's Jazza, and for completely unrelated Right Dishonourable reasons, I'm up in Scotland. And you know what? I've gone native. I have now decided that I back an independent Scotland. I'm fed up with all of them English people not taking our money. I'm fed up with all of the bullshit of Westminster. I'm ready to back Nicola Sturgeon to be the first Prime Minister. Oh, that I've stopped. Shall I stop? Was that too much? Was that offensive?
Because
actually that's all I've been doing while I've been up here is putting on Scottish accents.
I think it probably was offensive, but I quite enjoyed it. So
cool.
I'm happy just to run with it.
Excellent. I voted Remain, and I now regret the decisions I made for the opening of this podcast. Welcome to The Right Dishonourable. We meet weekly to talk about politics, social issues and current events. And yes, at the moment, we really are weekly. Very exciting.
Yeah, I think we are, actually. You know, hiccups in editing being allowed for. So it's quite impressive for us.
All right, let's not draw attention to it. Let's not draw attention to it. Shush.
I feel transparency is better over the long run, because if you're transparent about your mistakes, then people can relate to you and they don't attack you so harshly for it. Probably.
That is a fair point. Please, everybody, please love us.
To answer your previous question, we are going to be discussing three topics, as always, starting off with Iran's decision to seize a British-flagged oil tanker in the Strait of Hormuz. Is that how you say it? Hormuz? I've already forgotten.
Hormuz. Hormuz, okay. I think.
Hormuz.
Which is, fun fact, it's about as wide as the English Channel between England and France.
And it's somewhere in the Gulf, isn't it? Is that right?
Yes, so it's, I think it is the busiest, more oil passes through there than any other kind of like marine channel, including like the Suez Canal and kind of like other equivalents. And it's kind of like a point of contention for the Gulf region. It's where the majority of the Gulf's oil kind of exits the region from, and so it's really important for like oil prices and stuff like that. But yeah, the Iranians have seized an oil tanker from that was it's not from the UK, but it's UK flagged, which means that we kind of have responsibility for it in terms of security and stuff. But this was following the fact that we actually seized one of their oil tankers passing through the Straits of Gibraltar earlier this month. So it's like load of fun, grown-up countries playing tit for tat with oil tankers. This is going to turn out fine.
And with the famously diplomatic Boris Johnson coming into power as well, it's the...
Oh yeah, he's going to be great. He has a great history with Iran as well, doesn't he?
I think you're thinking of Turkey rather than Iran. They are.
I'm thinking of Iran.
Are you? Okay.
And the non-journalist.
Okay, we'll talk more about that later then, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Speaking of non-journalists, or alleged journalists...
Shots fired!
I mean, I'm not actually sure. I agree that this guy isn't a journalist, but this is the story that Stephen Edgington, who is primarily a Brexit Party digital strategist or guru... he's been variously named,
you've read the piece, right? He's got a long CV as an investigative journalist.
I don't think he has a long CV exactly.
I'm being facetious.
So he's written this piece for the Mail on Sunday, discussing his role in the leaks of the diplomatic cables that got our ambassador to the US. I was about to say fired, but he actually resigned before, I think he was, because he felt his situation become untenable. This story had originally been attributed to Isabel Oakeshott, who also has very strong links with the Brexit Party, and in particular Aaron Banks. But Stephen Edgington claims that he was the person that found the source for this, and then he collaborated with Isabel Oakeshott to get it published. But then, mysteriously, he was not bylined in the piece when it came out. So I mean, I think we'll be going sort of for it in a fair bit of detail for the, like for that reason. But it does seem kind of strange to me, and there's some claims in it that don't quite add up, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It just feels like a bit of a mess, and it feels like this young. He's kind of like a proto Tom Harwood, and his kind of he ran kind of like the West Monster. Like Twitter and social accounts for a while.
What is Westminster for the uninitiated?
It's like a libertarian. It's kind of like a more modern branded Guido, I would say. Holds a lot of politicians into contempt. Is very libertarian and kind of like conservative, UKIP, Brexit leaning.
It's very Brexity.
Very Brexity, but because none of the politicians can be trusted, because they do deals behind closed doors, which is definitely. Anyway, we'll not dive into that. But yeah, this kid's been set up, or has been encouraged to like take a shot for the team. Some of the things didn't really add up for me.
I mean, interestingly, this story has actually been published pretty much at the same time that the news came out that Darren Grimes, who was, I think he was the head of the Believe campaign during the Brexit referendum, he won his appeal against the £20,000 fine that he was originally given in relation to his coordination with Vote Leave. And particularly around coordinated spending and money therein. It should be said that Vote Leave have actually previously dropped their appeal against the £61,000 fine that they were that was administered against them in pretty much for the same infraction, really. So Vote Leave have been fined, but Darren Grimes appears to have got away with it, although the Electoral Commission has said that it might appeal.
It's something to do with the fact that he put himself as he ticked himself as kind of like the person to be held responsible rather than the organisation or something along those lines, right? And that's how he's been led off the hook, but Believe haven't.
Yeah, I haven't been able to find the full judgment, but it is around all the reports state that it is around the fact that he registered as an individual, but he should have registered as a group campaign. And that was why the fine was applied against him rather than the organization. I don't know if that fine has now been transferred to Believe, and I'm not even sure they'd have any money to pay that fine as an organization anyway. But it's not particularly good news for the Electoral Commission. And speaking of bad news, our third and final topic. Theresa May is standing down as Prime Minister. Is it on Tuesday or Wednesday next week?
Is that bad news?
It's not bad news that she's standing down, but we are going to be taking a look at her legacy, which I think has been dominated by bad news. Only that. I don't think she has very many achievements to her name, at least during her time as Prime Minister. I suppose we're going to... You may dispute that when we get to that topic.
Jimmy, my whole argument mainly hinges around me just feeling sorry for the poor lady.
Okay. let's play some music and ask you for money, and then we can find out just what Jasmine means by that when we actually get round to that topic.
Bless her. I can't help that I have lots of empathy.
You could stop it, mate. Or just keep it to yourself. You don't need to be sharing that stuff around. Hi there. If you're enjoying The Right Dishonourable, and we hope you are, there are various ways that you can support the show. Probably the easiest way is to go to twitter.com/rightdishonour, follow us there, send us any feedback you have, what you think we might be able to improve about the show, what you're liking about the show, all that sort of stuff. If you want to send us a bit of money, you can go to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. That's just a standard Patreon account, so I'm sure most of you know how that works. As always, we'd like to thank our current patrons, David Warner, Emerson Sparks, Gemma Cumming, John O, Matt and Ollie McGregor. Thank you very much for your support, and hopefully more people will be joining you very soon. So, Jezza, as you pointed out in the introduction, Iran decided to seize the British-flagged oil tanker as partly in response to Britain doing something similar near Gibraltar. In the British case, the authorities claim that they did so because that tanker was violating sanctions relating to the shipping of, I think it was the shipping of oil to Syria. But in this case, this is a, you know, in Iran's case, seizing the British flag tanker, which is called the Stena Impero. It seems more like a tit for tat thing. Do you think just on purely that point, this makes it look as though Iran's in the wrong, if you're an impartial observer?
There's so much background to this, and I think you have to go back to it's Trump cancelling the Iran nuclear deal.
No, yeah, that was in 2018.
And so that so that has kind of been the catalyst of increased bad relations between the United States and Iran. European nations have maintained the nuclear deal with Iran. So the UK, France and Germany, but the UK, importantly in this case, is one of them that has maintained the deal and hasn't backed out of it. A problem that we have is that we see ourselves as having a really close relationship with the United States anyway. We are currently about to enter into a position where we need the United States to be on side and to like us quite a lot. This is before kind of like the ambassador revelations were released as well. I think we're descending into kind of like Britain as being the US's like poodle again, kind of. So essentially, the decision to seize the Iranian tanker came as a request by the British off the coast of Gibraltar. Was a request by the Trump White House.
Is that confirmed? Because I've only in reading
it's not confirmed. Yeah, it's not like confirmed, but it's pretty like it's probably like that's probably what's happened. And we can't really say no to that kind of stuff to the US anymore, because we need like good relations for the trade deal, because I think an awful lot of the desires of those in power at the moment of Brexit not being really, really bad hinge on a United States and a quick US trade deal, which is contingent on Trump actually quite liking us. One of the things that actually Andrew Neil, the BBC journalist and presenter, what he mentioned on Twitter was actually it was curious that we seized the Iranian tanker and then didn't do anything to kind of shore up the defences of our tankers going through what's the strip called? I can't remember the name of the strip.
You mean the Strait of Hormuz?
Strait of Hormuz, yeah. So we didn't start protecting our tankers going through the Strait of Hormuz, not anticipating that that was going to be a problem.
Well, I think Alan West, who used to be, well, I think he still is titled as Lord Admiral, but I think he's retired now. Admiral Lord West. He said that there'd actually been some historic cuts in that to sort of British defence shipping in that kind of in that area that hadn't actually been turned around in the last couple of years. I think, you know, given that he's a former Navy guy, he is the sort of person that would almost always be keen on more naval spending just because of his role. But it does seem as though there's something he says in this Guardian piece that there should have been 4 escort ships in the region around Hormuz, and then he cites that there have been cuts to our surface fleets by successive governments. So this is partly a historical thing, and this is, you know, this incident has actually highlighted a long-standing problem, as he sees it anyway.
We actually, so they the kind of recordings, which are really fascinating, of the conversation between the HMS Montrose, who were a battleship kind of trying to intervene with the Iranian people seizing the Stena Imperio. Like it was fascinating hearing them being like, hey, you are breaking international law here by... hey, do you want to not? Was essentially what they say. But the Montrose was too far away to actually do anything about it. They just had to kind of like waggle around their dicks from afar, essentially, over the radios. But it is like Andrew Neil suggested that the UK government and were distracted by other things, namely one, Brexit, and two, there being a leadership election, which includes the current foreign secretary. Do you think that may have had anything to do with how this has ended up out of negligence happening?
I think Brexit in general probably is a wider cause of negligence it's the cause of negligence for all sorts of things, but I think it definitely feeds in somewhat to the kind of military angle as well. Jeremy Hunt I think has been interested in maintaining at least his kind of diplomatic role, because when there were discussions around the sacking of Sir Kim Darragh, yeah, sorry, the British ambassador to the US, he was actually if I recall correctly, he did actually back Kim in actually saying
we're on first name terms with the ambassador. All right, Kim, how are you doing?
Sorry, he backed Kim Darrow in and said that he actually had confidence that he could continue in his role, and Boris Johnson notably didn't. Obviously, if you are actually holding a leadership election, I mean, if you're having any sort of election, it's going to distract you from the day-to-day tasks of government, and that includes things like foreign relations and military affairs. So, yeah, I think that does have a role.
Mm-hmm. Are we all going to die?
What, because this is going to prompt some sort of nuclear war?
Maybe not a nuclear war, but do you think that is war now kind of... Is this the slippery slope towards, like, a proper war with Iran?
There have been, even before this particular incident, there have been increased rumblings about a potential war with Iran, for reasons that I'm actually not 100% clear on. Obviously, relations between the US and Iran are not good because of Trump's stance around the nuclear deal. In some ways, Iran actually would be quite keen to have that nuclear deal back on the table, because it does actually facilitate their economic engagement with the rest of the world, and particularly with those European powers you mentioned earlier. One of the problems around the Iran deal is that actually, even though it would allow European banks, say, to actually engage with Iran, there was a certain amount of reluctance to do so because they were afraid that the deal would collapse, or that it just wasn't a very viable or safe place to actually do business with, because it was very the diplomatic environment was very fragile around it. I'm sure that in Iran there is a split between those that actually favour engagement and want to actually get diplomatic engagement and economic engagement with the West back on the table, and then there's probably more hawkish elements that are actually saying, yeah, let's go and actually cause some trouble and actually fight and kind of get our way that way. Because, you know, that...
And call their bluff, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is, in some ways, I guess, seizing a tanker is actually testing the waters, as it were. So, mm-hmm. You know, seeing what you can get away with and how far you can push things. There's people like John Bolton, who's a national security advisor in the US, who are quite keen on a war with Iran. But, you know, Trump himself is actually not the most hawkish person. He has a pretty mixed record on backing military action, but
yeah.
He did run...
Yeah,
go on.
Yeah, no, well, I was going to jump in and probably say that what you were about to say. He ran on a really anti-war platform, actually, making sure that the US wouldn't get involved in foreign wars. And say what you want about Trump, like, he's actually... He does what he said... He's been quite good at kind of at least the theatrics of following through with what he promised on the campaign trail in 2000 and in the run up to 2016. So that's kind of quite interesting Like, you can't really spin a war to not be a war. Do you know what I mean? And for me, like, I tweeted out just the word fuck when I found out that Iranians had seized a UK vessel, because it means that we and that vessel and the UK now are implicated in any decision that the US makes. And because we are such a weak... We are a country that is very weak in terms of, like, international relations now, and we need the US as a close ally, especially as we are pissing off everybody else, frankly. And if the US went to war with Iran, we would automatically be implicated in that. Like, we would have to support the United States and support them, like, properly, not just, like, half-assedly as we have in the past with some US interventions. And that's what kind of worries me, is how we aren't going to be able to have the kind of rhetoric that actually Jeremy Hunt has had up until this point. I don't think that a Boris Johnson premiership is going to be able to have that.
Well, I think the likelihood is that even without these tanker incidents, the UK would probably end up involved in a US-Iran war in some capacity anyway, whether that would actually translate into troops on the ground or just some other more peripheral support, I don't know. But I think that is just the nature of the US-UK relationship, is that we tend to support them in some of these foreign adventures, well-advised or otherwise. You mentioned Boris Johnson there. When he, you know, we're sort of assuming that he will become Prime Minister at this point, but when he becomes Prime Minister and this situation is still on, you know, lands on his desk, you know, is on his desk when he takes up the job, basically, what do you think his response is going to be to it?
He's gonna have to follow whatever the US does. Like, obviously, continuing to try and, like, de-escalate things, but I think, unfortunately, he's going to have to default to what the US position is. And, like, make that case. I think, actually, yeah, like, in the grand... Well, no, I think Iran's objectively going to be a lot worse than Iraq ever was.
You mean in terms of the war? The war's going to be a lot more complicated. A potential war's going to be more complicated with them. And...
Yeah, yeah. Not least because it's, like, a bigger country. It has nuclear capabilities. We think it has nuclear capabilities... They're not meant to.
Is that true? I mean, they have uranium sort of enrichment facilities, but I've never got the impression that translates to actual weapons.
Yeah, they don't actually have weapons, right? Yeah, that's not correct. Yeah, sorry about that. Sorry, dear listeners, but you don't come here for accuracy.
Yeah, I mean, there's all of the problems with Iraq, because, you know, if they were to invade Iran, it would be with some sort of goal of regime change. And, you know, displacing the government there and actually replacing it with something that's more sympathetic to Western interests, or, you know, in particular US interests. And, you know, you don't have to be particularly well informed to know that Iraq didn't exactly go well on those fronts. And I think you're right that this is actually a more complicated situation. Iran is, you know, is a more significant country for all sorts of reasons than Iraq was. And it, you know... Anything involving that country has the potential to actually spill over to the neighbouring countries and just destabilise the Middle Eastern situation more widely. It's an incredibly dangerous project to undertake. And, you know, for that reason alone, it is actually pretty worrying that this situation has come up. But on the other hand, the idea of Iran that actually does become nuclear armed, that does create nuclear weapons, in some ways is even more frightening, don't you think?
Yes. But I'm kind of unconvinced, and I think this may be my own confirmation bias, but to be honest, whenever Donald Trump falls on the side of an argument, I'm automatically skeptical of it.
That's probably not a terrible rule of thumb, I don't think.
No. And actually, to be completely honest, I don't understand enough about the international, the sanctions that already exist, and kind of the nuclear deal that existed with Iran, obviously signed by Barack Obama and other Western leaders. I'm not sure how rigorous those, like, checks are. I know that there are regular checks, and I would assume it's quite hard to hide nuclear weapons facilities from, like, the United Nations, but I don't like, I don't know, man. I don't know. I don't know enough about it. I just have my assumptions as kind of like a layperson. But then, who is Trump?
Yeah, I mean, in any of these scenarios, you don't really know what you know, what kind of intelligence that top level decision makers actually have access to. Although, you know, bearing in mind that the Iraq intelligence wasn't exactly bulletproof, we should be skeptical about people, you know, about politicians citing that sort of thing as justification for these kind of potential wars. But I mean, in many ways, it is a scary story. But I think it's, in a lot of these incidents, I mean, we've discussed kind of various North Korean nuclear tests, and they generate a lot of furore at the time. But there's always the possibility that it is a bit of a blip, and then actually things die down and people cool off. So that seems more likely at this stage in this scenario, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. It depends what happens with the tanker, frankly. And also it depends on what is going to happen under, like, when we change prime ministers in like 3 days. I would be interested to see what the new foreign secretary, and it probably is going to be a new foreign secretary. I'd be surprised if Hunt was allowed to continue in that position. I'd be curious to see what they ended up deciding to do. But it does freak me out a little bit. It inches ever closer, like, this possibility. And like, the US seems to have, or at least certain types of Republicans, like the really hawkish international interventionalist ones, have been eyeing up Iran for a really long time. And we know that they've been eyeing up Iran because they control an awful lot of the oil in the region, and they control kind of like the straits in that region, and like, that's kind of what they are. It's all of the Western allies on the south bank of the strait, and then and it's Iran on the north. So you have like the Saudi Arabia, Oman, etc., who are all kind of like United States allies, but not the nicest people. And then you have Iran on the north, and that kind of that is seen as instability in the region, and that's why Iran has kind of like been eyed up for such a long time, because they're not an automatic. They're not automatically aligned with Western agendas.
Mm. Yeah, I'd agree with all of that. I mean, it's worth mentioning, just on the this was something that I picked up when I was actually doing some background research for this topic.
Oh, look at you!
So Donald Trump actually called off a retaliation bombing that the US was this was against Iran. And this was in response to Iran shooting down an unmanned aerial vehicle operated by the US. So, you know, that's actually much more aggressive, I think, even than seizing an oil tanker. And in the end, Donald Trump decided not to do anything about it. I know these sort of events can escalate, but, you know, I'm skeptical that there is actually much appetite for actually turning this into a full-scale conflict, at least at this stage.
Yeah, I agree that there isn't, but I think that these things can escalate really, really quickly.
Mm.
And the only thing that is kind of like Trump does not want to go to war. He doesn't want to have that, especially going into as ammunition against him is going into the 2020 elections, which are still so far away. Oh my God! But what is worrying for me as a Brit is that. We're relying on Trump keeping his cool and keeping that promise that he made to voters for us not to be dragged in. As soon as the US goes in, I don't feel like we're going to have a choice but to endorse them wholeheartedly. And once again, be kind of like drawing a line down the English Channel and kind of separating us when it comes to foreign policy and decisions about intervention with who are our closest allies? Europe. But hey-ho.
I mean,
Brexit, such an opportunity.
Militarily, the US are closer allies to us than Europe are. I mean, we have a closer relationship to all of the Anglosphere countries, really, when it comes to military matters. It's more on the trading side that we're closer to Europe. And that would be true irrespective of Brexit. Brexit is obviously a factor in all of this, and a complicated one.
I don't
one,
know,
but...
I think that there's a perception of that perhaps because of Iraq, but NATO ties Europe pretty closely together.
Well, I mean, for instance, in terms of military intelligence sharing, the UK, Five Eyes is a thing, and that binds the UK, the US, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand together. And yeah, I mean, I just think that there is that history of the UK, particularly the UK and Australia, are actually backing US foreign intervention more readily than the likes of France and Germany and that sort of thing. So there is kind of a tradition there, which I think does matter. But you're obviously right about NATO. But strictly speaking, this, you know, as far as I can make out, this doesn't really have much to do with NATO, from what I can tell.
Yeah. I agree. Cool, shall we move on?
We probably should move on. There's no neat way to segue here. So I'm just going to say, Stephen Edgington, Jazza, you tweeted something earlier. I think it was something to the effect of, we're either all journalists or none of us are journalists. And I'm
sounds
sure
deep, doesn't it?
It does sound deep. Is Steve Edgington a journalist, do you think?
No, fuck you, Jimmy. I was going to ask you that. I think that Stephen Edgington is actually an interesting embodiment of a phenomenon that we've seen, and maybe I don't think that this is necessarily a new thing, but I certainly notice it on an awful lot, especially from kind of like the younger Brexit guys and girls, where they have come from political ideology campaigning or being like a mouthpiece for that political ideology, being a little bit trolley, then going into kind of like the campaigning side of stuff, and now are treated as journalists. And maybe I have like more of a lofty ideal of what a journalist is, Jimmy. Maybe your great work has turned me onto this and swayed me. But I feel like there isn't a huge amount of journalism that goes into just kind of like rabbiting what people have told you and being kind of like a mouthpiece for politicians. I feel like politicians should make their own statements.
You're talking about the kind of outrider phenomenon, aren't you?
Yeah. Like they use somebody like Edgington to propagate the idea that they want to kind of like disseminate into the public consciousness, because it's not as viable for them to be able to do that.
Hmm.
And like Edgington calls himself a journalist, but he has like, he's very open in the, good God, it's a really bloody long article, and it goes into like his
this is the article in the on the Daily Mail website,
in the Daily Mail, which he wrote, and it goes in, he basically ends up writing his CV up. It's like, for goodness sake, I didn't care how many A levels he did, mate. But he talks about how he was a video journalist for Westminster, did some stuff with the Taxpayers Alliance and Leave Means Leave, so great guy. And then worked for the Brexit Party in the... I don't know why you're laughing. And then worked for the Brexit Party in the run-up to the EU elections. And then he goes on to say, I appreciate that my CV and my pro-Brexit views will inevitably fuel the conspiracy theories, but I want to be absolutely clear. : The leak of Sir Kim's cables had absolutely nothing to do with the Brexit Party. And that's... like, in terms of like it being having anything to do with the Brexit Party, that can technically be true, but for it to be motivated by somebody who is aligned with the Brexit Party and those people, I mean, look at that CV, that's undeniable. And like, I'm like, how much can you claim to be a journalist when you come from kind of like these? I mean, it's marketing, it's political campaigning and marketing backgrounds. So I don't know. Is he a journalist? And this is why I was like, if he's a journalist, then I'm a bloody journalist.
I think you've engaged in acts of journalism previously, haven't you? I mean, you did that video when you went to the US and looked at sort of gays and gun rights, didn't you? I mean, that was journalism,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Yes, I like how you phrase it, though. I have engaged in acts of journalism, but I attach, and I think this is more me, I attach a romanticism and perhaps lofty ideals to the act of journalism that I do not feel I partake in. I think I kind of fall on the John Stewart kind of side of things, where he's people have always wanted him and have often wanted him as a comedian who did The Daily Show for such a long time. He's like, I'm not a journalist. I'm here kind of like, I'm a communicator. I make stuff funny for people. I'm a comedian. And I think I probably fall into like that side of stuff. Like, I'm more of a satirist than I am a journalist. And I think that those are really important distinctions to make. And maybe if I feel like that around kind of being somebody who makes satire, wanting to be distinct from somebody who makes journalism, I feel like people who partake in campaigning also need to kind of separate themselves from the act of journalism, because I think that's why journalism perhaps doesn't have it's one of the most hated professions.
Well, it's one of the least trusted professions, if you believe Ipsos Mori's polling.
Does any of that make sense? That was a bit word vomity, but that's kind of like, those are my feelings about it, and why I'm like, well, if this guy claims he's a journalist, then we're all bloody journalists because we've all got Twitter accounts.
See, I thought you actually articulated your position quite well, that there should be some separation, as it were, between campaigners or, you know, people who are playing the game and people who are just watching it. From my point of view, I kind of disagree with this, with that kind of attitude, actually. I mean, I don't kind of disagree, I just do disagree. I think in practice, journalism is part of the game. And I think that there's just this very highfalutin view of journalism that is actually propagated by some journalists, that they can actually stand aside from things and be, you know, properly objective about what's going on. And in practice, I don't think that's possible. I think that, you know, reporting the news inevitably means that you're viewing it from some angle, you're reporting it from somebody's point of view. And that point of view might be just the expected audience for the article. So if you're writing, say, for Reuters, which is a newswire, a lot of people, you know, Reuters is used in things like Bloomberg terminals, so there needs to be kind of a fair degree of objectivity or impartiality, in the sense of you're just looking at things, you're not trying to hawk one particular side or the other, but that is still a point of view, you know. And if you're deciding to pick up on certain things, and the way you actually decide to order different facts, or whether you decide to include facts or exclude facts and all the rest of it, once you actually break it down, all news reporting is partial in some sense. I mean, it's partial in the sense that it is reported from certain people's point of view. It emphasizes certain angles.
That's something I strongly agree with. Like, news is always filtered through the eyes of whoever saw it.
Yes. And I don't think you can fully get away with that. And, you know, historically speaking, that's a slightly more highbrow, high-level look at things. But if you're talking about campaigners versus outriders, which is the kind of people like Owen Jones, who are very strongly affiliated to a particular political party, in Jones' cases, it's Corbyn's Labour Party, versus journalists who actually don't have any political affiliation. So I think a good example of that would be somebody like Owen Bennett, who I think these days writes for the Huffington Post. There is a distinction there, and, you know, I personally would trust something from Owen Bennett more than I would Owen Jones, for that reason, because you understand that Jones is in part a campaigner, he's in part an activist. Owen Jones would also say, in fairness to him, that he's a columnist, so he's actually paid to write opinions rather than report on things. But I mean, I think the distinction is not necessarily as neat as all that. And, you know, when you decide to report something, you are doing so because you think that attention needs to be drawn from it. And sometimes that might be motivated by a sense of justice, which is quite political in and of itself. Sometimes it might be motivated by corruption. Sometimes it's just for the sake of mischief as well. And I don't think any of those motivations are utterly impartial, is what I'm saying. So, you know, in summary, to get back to the original question, I think Stephen Edgington is a journalist. It's not his main job. Like, his main job is clearly as a campaigner, you know, for various political causes. And he's a very partisan journalist, if you want to put it that way. That, you know, I haven't looked at Westminster in great depth, but it does seem to be very partial in its outlook, which is fine.
They're fun to follow, Jimmy.
Yes.
Well, at least they were for a while.
I think it's fine to be actually biased as a journalist, because I think all journalists are ultimately biased for one reason or another. And I think you know, there is something to be said about trying to be more objective and, you know, trying to be fair. There's a sense of fair dealing, I think, that's quite important. And, you know, with somebody who works for the Brexit Party, do you necessarily get a sense of fair dealing when it comes to stories such as, you know, the British ambassador to the US said about Donald Trump? You know, that's quite a partial story, I think, that, you know, so yeah, I think he's a journalist, but he is a partisan one. So, and I think that's fine, really.
Yeah, to be really clear, he's not come out as the leak. He's come out as kind of like the buffer between. What's her name? Why can't I not?
Is it Isabel Oakeshott?
Isabel Oakeshott, my God. He's come out as the person who initially spoke to Isabel Oakeshott, who was initially approached by the leak, and then passed it on to Isabel Oakeshott. After which Isabel Oakeshott took full credit for the story.
Yeah, so the byline thing doesn't make a lot of sense, I don't think.
Yeah.
It's one of my main, I mean, this was raised by other people on Twitter, so I don't claim original credit for this, but he said that he wanted to develop his career as a journalist, you know, wanted to make a name for himself, wanted to get some profile. And yet in this story, which, you know, was a dynamite story, did actually lead to somebody resigning, he didn't actually put himself in the byline. And obviously he's come out now and said, I'm responsible for this, but that doesn't really make any sense on its face. And he just says, you know, we developed the story before providing it to the Mail on Sunday. Given the possible controversy, we decided to leave my name out of it. I don't get that. Like, that doesn't, that raises more questions than it answers.
I think that could be, it wouldn't, I'm just saying, Isabel Oakeshott doesn't come across as the most philanthropic of individuals. So I can imagine her being like, her convincing him in kind of like, come little bird, come under my wing, let me coach you, there'll be a great future for you. And her saying like, oh, it totally makes sense for this to be under my name. So that she gets the credit for the story, and trying to convince him perhaps that it makes more sense for him to be left out.
Possibly.
Like, the whole thing is, like, that is kind of like me giving the benefit of the doubt to them, or to Stephen. I feel like this is just a way of being able to cover Isabel Oakeshott's back, because we know that there are legal implications here for the leak specifically, and therefore also perhaps implications for the journalists who ended up writing about it and publishing it. And if the further that Isabel Oakeshott is removed from the leak themselves, the easier it is for her.
You mean if it's implied that she doesn't actually know who the source of the story was, like the original source of the story? But yeah. I mean, even that seems improbable, doesn't it? Like, you're gonna stick your byline to a story based on an anonymous leak.
Right.
Well, sorry, a leak that is anonymized from the point of view of the audience. You're going to want to know who the leaker is.
Well, it to me shows that she's clearly okay with stealing stories from people and taking all of the credit for them. Or they're throwing this kid, who's 19 years old, by the way, they're throwing this kid under the bus. And kind of like they've said, we promise to look after you. Make sure that you say that the leak came to you rather than anything. And it's also, it doesn't, like, if he were the leak, if he were the civil servant who had decided to do that, maybe there'd be some implications here, but there just don't seem to be. It's a really odd move from kind of like that crew that we assume includes like the Aaron Bankses, the Isabel Oakeshotts, and the Nigel Farages, who have kind of like, we assume orchestrated like this attack on the British ambassador ended up with him losing his job. Does it smell as fishy to you? Are you pontificating in the same way that I am?
I mean, yeah, basically, because I mean, Isabel Oakeshott, as well as ghostwriting Aaron Banks' book about the Brexit campaign, is also now apparently dating Richard Tice, who's the chairman of the Brexit Party. She's embroiled, you know, multiple ways in the Brexit establishment, I guess you could call them that. And yeah, I mean, it It seems very unlikely that if she'd got hold of this red hot story, that she wouldn't have discussed it with her with the man she was dating, who also happens to be the chairman of the Brexit Party. You know, whether the story originally came through somebody else within the within that kind of group, I don't really know. I think it would be very hard to ascertain that if you're coming from outside of that group. But yeah, it does smell a bit fishy, I think. And you know, particularly the way that Steve and Edgington has actually written this piece, you know, a little bit after the actual leak came out, claiming some credit for it. That, I mean, that's also very odd, I think. You know, I don't want to go into like full blown conspiracy theorists, but it doesn't really pass the smell test, this whole thing. Like the claim that, you know, somebody passed, I mean, apart from anything else, why would senior civil servants speak to Stephen Edgington where he doesn't really have much...
a 19-year-old blogger, frankly.
Well, vlogger, principally. I mean, previously he has actually done interviews with people like Alistair Campbell. So he obviously has some skill in terms of drumming up, you know, drumming up people to speak to. So it's not impossible, yeah. But...
His interviews are actually, like, he's a good interviewer. And it makes sense that he's ended up being taken seriously in this space. Like, I don't want to undermine him at all. I think he is actually quite good, like, as an interviewer and in, like, the video endeavours that he does.
Yeah, I mean, but if you wanted to, if you wanted to sort of get Sir Kim Darrow thrown out of office, would it not be better to speak to a more senior journalist such as Isabel Oakeshott, who used to be a political editor for one of the Sunday titles, I think, on Fleet Street, or somebody like, I've forgotten his name, Tim Shipman from the Sunday Times, or, you know, there's loads and loads of people you could have actually passed this story to. Why are you passing it to a relatively unknown person? Bizarre, I think. I mean, if you want to get coverage for something, the way you do it is you pass it to, I mean, admittedly, a sympathetic journalist who works for a big newspaper title, because that's where it will get the most exposure. So yeah, for that reason, I am skeptical. But you know, it is possible. It's within the bounds of possibility that he actually did find this story himself, and then did what he said he did, pass it on to Isabel Oakeshott. But it doesn't seem like the most likely scenario, I don't think.
No. Yeah. Same. Right. So, Theresa May go by Boris Johnson probably come in.
No, we need to discuss Darren Grimes before we go on.
Oh right. Okay. Fine. Remember to cut this bit out, Jimmy.
I may do. I may not. So switching to Darren Grimes, who is the sort of former leader of the Be Leave campaign, which was a youth Brexit campaign that worked probably a bit too closely with Vote Leave.
Can I just say, the Brexit side, great puns.
I think you said that last time when we discussed the Be Leave campaign.
I just want to make it very clear that I disagree with almost everything they stand for, but I appreciate their marketing.
Okay. Glad you've made that clear. So Darren Grimes, after it was found that Vote Leave actually had basically breached the spending limit by transferring some, I don't know if they transferred it directly, I can't remember the details, but money that was sort of linked to Vote Leave had actually gone to Be Leave, would actually push the total spending by the group over the limit, which is what ended up with Vote Leave being fined £61,000. And then Darren Grimes at the same time was fined £20,000 because he'd been registered as an individual campaigner with the Electoral Commission, and therefore I guess he was felt to be legally liable. This has now been overturned by a court of appeal, and the judge has said that firstly he said he didn't think the offence could be proved satisfactorily by the commission, i.e. they didn't have enough evidence to really state that this was the case, but he also thought that even if they could have proved it, the fine was probably too high given the infraction. And it does relate to the thing you were saying earlier, Jazza, about Grimes had registered as an individual rather than a group campaigner. The way that Grimes presents this is that he sort of filled in the paperwork wrong, made an honest mistake, and was until recently going to be fined £20,000 for it. This is all really bad for the Electoral Commission, whatever you think about anything else that's going on, isn't it?
Is it, do you think? Because I feel like the I kind of hate talking about the funding side of the Brexit campaigns on both sides, because it just shows how kind of like dodgy funding in politics is anyway, because it depends not how much money there is, but like where it's being filtered through, and there's loads of loopholes that you have to do and make sure that the right box is ticked and all of that kind of stuff. And we know that the Remain campaign spent more than the Leave campaign overall.
I don't think it was it wasn't the Remain campaign per se, but when you factor in things like the £9 million leaflet that David Cameron set out, was stating the government position, so fair enough. But when you sort of count other spending, it can be argued that the Remain campaigners on the whole spent more than Leave campaigners.
Yes, but obviously, again, that depends on how you frame it, blah, 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 blah.
It does.
It feels like here the wrong people are being blamed, and like yet again, similarly to the previous story we were talking about our Steve Eddington, this is yet again I think some young, really bright and ambitious kind of like libertarian right wing kids kind of being thrown under the bus by their older counterparts. Because this to me, as kind of like an external observer, this was clearly something that went through the Vote Leave campaign and is the fault of the Vote Leave campaign rather than anything to do with BLeave. And I think that it's quite kind of... like, obviously, the way that the law is set out, it now falls on BLeave's shoulders. But these were just some ambitious young people who wanted to kind of like be part of this big seismic potential change in British politics. And it is the Vote Leave people who should have known better.
Yeah, I mean, I do kind of agree with that. Although I will say that when I think Darren Grimes, I think he's 25 now? I think he was a couple of years younger, obviously, when the actual referendum campaign took place. But he was a man, you know. He was a full grown adult with
But what did you know about electoral law in your early 20s, mate?
I mean, nothing. But I was also not campaigning in any capacity. So you know, if you decide to go and do something, the onus is, and you're a full grown adult, the onus is on you to actually find out some of the legalities around it. I mean, you know, we occasionally have jokey discussions around libel law on this podcast. And we've had those discussions since we started the podcast, where we were, you know, a similar age to what Darren Grimes was. And if we'd ever been caught out, you know, actually libeling someone and then taken to court, we could not have just said, oh, let us off, Gov. We're quite young. Yes, we're quite green behind the ears.
Yeah, but we... actually, you told me that that is a very good defence.
Yeah, it is. You know, ignorance is actually quite a good defence. But given the extensive discussions we've had that have been recorded and then broadcast about libel law, and the fact I have a journalism qualification, I don't think that would end well for us.
So because of your journalism qualification, you will sacrifice yourself for me, and that means a lot, Jimmy. Thank you so much for agreeing to do that. But I think that there is equivalence there, but I think that it would be closer if we were like an affiliate podcast to maybe The Times or like LBC or whatever. The fact that there is a parent company that does have expertise in this, has done this before, has walked this walk, knows the laws, and should actually be looking after the people that it is employing to, I was going to say, do its dirty work, but that would imply that I'm biased.
I think there's a certain amount
of responsibility that the Vote Leave should have had to these... I'm going to keep on calling them kids, because they are bright and smart and perform really, really well on TV and know what they want and are really ambitious. But these are young people that I think are being taken advantage of by abandoned, I think, actually, to a certain extent, by the powers that be on that side of politics.
Yeah, I think that's all a fair argument, certainly in terms of whether legal liability should have fallen. I think it was kind of, you know, a 20 grand fine against like some kid who doesn't, well, you know, 20 something man is pretty harsh, I think, for all the reasons you've just said. I do want to discuss briefly before we move on to the Theresa May side of things, The Electoral Commission has clearly misunderstood its own rules in actually levelling this fine against Grimes, or, you know, at least it seems to be that way given the appeal verdict. And previously they were actually criticised by another judge for having given vote leave erroneous advice, and that was actually relating to the transferring of funds from, you know, from vote leave into B leave. Which the way Vote Leave presents that is that they thought that they were fine because the Electoral Commission had said so, but the judge, you know, the judge decided that they had actually broken electoral law, but the Electoral Commission hadn't interpreted its rules properly and therefore had given wrongful advice. Which, I mean, from my point of view, it seems a bit ridiculous that Vote Leave are actually still going to be fined, given that they were given bad advice by the body, the official body that was supposed to be enforcing these rules. That seems crazy to me, but both of these instances together do seem to suggest to me that the Electoral Commission is probably not really a fit organisation at this point. I'm not saying it should be abolished, but there's clearly some very severe problems that are going on there.
I'm less convinced by the severe problem. I feel, is this not just kind of the checks and balances of the legal system, making sure that the Electoral Commission does its job properly? And it, like, the judgment that the Electoral Commission has done has decided to be overturned because it got taken to court. The thing that worries me is that Grimes had to raise the funds for this himself. He relied on donations for it. And I think that you should be able to appeal court decisions without having to go to the internet and ask and basically start a GoFundMe. But I'm less convinced that this is kind of like a... says that the commission isn't doing its job properly. I think it's actually shows that it is doing its job properly, and it is taking into consideration like new information and clarifications of information.
Well, it seems not to understand the rules it's supposed to enforce very well. You know what I mean? Like, it just seems that whoever is, you know, whichever people are involved in actually enforcing the rules around the referendum spending, because both these cases relate to that, don't really know what's going on.
Well, probably because the enforcers and the people who decided the laws and the people who enforce the laws are probably very different groups of people.
Mm.
And so there has to be, and I like that would be normal.
Yeah, that is normal.
Right.
Yeah.
right,
but there doesn't seem to be a suggestion that the rules themselves are flawed as such. It just seems that the Electoral Commission is not very good at interpreting them and applying them to actual instances.
Maybe. I actually think because that there are these clarifications of their decisions that it's a good thing. That it isn't kind of like all set to bed. I worry about the amount of money that you need in order for that to actually happen. Because these institutions are always... like, you can't make everything perfect. Like, they are going to make errors sometimes. But making sure that there are processes that make sure that they can roll their decisions back or clarify their decisions in certain ways, I think that's actually... that shows that it is working properly.
Well, they said that the Electoral Commission said it was disappointed by the verdict, which is like a standard thing you say when you lose, you know, your organisation. But is it disappointed because it fucked up, or is it disappointed because it doesn't really believe it fucked up and it believes that the court is wrong? It has said that it might still appeal the decision, or it's left that option open, which, you know, does imply that they, you know, they might think that they're in the right ultimately.
Yeah, well, like, actually, like, I think it's a we talked about this already. Like, I think it's a little bit gross that a fine got put on the shoulders of an individual when it's clearly not the individual's fault. Like, I think there should be some consequences to it, and maybe that's what the commission means, but we'll see if they end up appealing it. I think it would be the wrong decision for them to end up going after Grimes as an individual again, because that is clearly not where the malpractice happened here. I don't think the way that it is described in some of the publicized things from the judge is to be honest, it feels like something I would do. and so I'm quite sympathetic to Grimes's position, actually.
I mean, I really hate paperwork, and the idea of having to do paperwork and then be fined for doing that paperwork wrongly, that is scary. I think that's scary to us all.
enjoy those nightmares, guys. Am I allowed to ask you about Theresa May now?
You are indeed. Let's wrap up. Theresa May's legacy.
So she's leaving. She's going to do Prime Minister's Questions for the last time this coming Wednesday. Then she is going to step down in the early afternoon, and then probably Boris Johnson, we don't know 100%, but probably Boris Johnson is going to be declared the it is going to take up his position in number 10. Whoop-dee-doo. Theresa May is widely... I mean, even Trump has been saying that she did a bad job. no point in holding his hand was there, Theresa. I have really enjoyed kind of like the I give no shits attitude of Theresa May in the last few weeks, though, where she... like when Trump made the comments about the... Congresswomen of color in the United States House of Representatives, she basically said, "Yeah, that's pretty fucking racist, dude. Shouldn't have said that." and she's just like, "I give no fucks anymore. I don't have to like keep this crazy giant Cheeto man happy anymore." So I've kind of enjoyed that, and the way that she has talked about kind of like she's defended the ambassador in the face of Trump. I've enjoyed. The stuff that she's been doing in the last like 2 weeks of her premiership, but she's been widely kind of like people say that she's probably going to be remembered for very little other than being a failed Brexit prime minister and defined by Brexit and not being able to do anything else with her time. What do you think is the most significant thing that she has done with her time as prime minister outside of Brexit?
I don't think she's done anything significant outside of Brexit. correct me if I'm wrong. There have been no... I mean, the major sort of domestic policy issue that came up during her premiership was the Grenfell fire, basically. And her response to that from a, you know, public relations point of view was not particularly good. Although I think in many ways people... people worry too much about like prime ministers and mayors and presidents coming down to disaster scenes when realistically they can't actually do very much and will probably be better off back in the office. But you know, that was a disaster that happened while she was prime minister. I don't think there's any connection that she had in her previous roles that actually enabled that to take place in terms of the cladding and of the building and whatnot. But, you know, when she came into office as prime minister, she talked about tackling burning injustices and she talked about sort of social unfairness and the fact that people are born into different scenario, you know, situations and your life chances massively differ. And that agenda was not really touched upon, I don't think. I mean, there's probably some smaller policies here and there that you could actually attribute to that instinct, but... In general, she has no major achievements to her name as prime minister, you know, which seems harsh. So I think you could talk quite a lot about her previous role as Home Secretary, and I think she did, whether you think it was good or bad, I think she did a lot of significant things while she was Home Secretary.
She was. I mean, that was kind of inevitable because she's the longest serving Home Secretary of modern times.
Yeah. How long was she in the role for? Do you remember offhand?
It would have been six, seven years.
Probably, yeah. Because was she appointed at the start of David Cameron's premiership?
She was Home Secretary for the whole of David Cameron's tenure.
There you go. And I there's quite a lot about her time as Home Secretary that I don't particularly like. I think in terms of sort of internet security and privacy, she was very much on the side of law and order.
Yeah,
and not,
she loves to overreach, doesn't she?
Yeah, and just not interested in people's privacy at all, really. And I think had very poor instincts. So, I mean, one of the reliefs of her premiership is that she didn't really have any time to follow up on those bad attitudes. Although we do have the porn block thing.
The porn block has been paused indefinitely.
Indefinitely now, okay.
Yes, yeah. They've just gone, it looks like this is actually hard and a bad idea. Whoopsie.
But I mean, the fact that, I mean, I don't, I'm not sure what role she had in actually shaping that legislation, but it did come through while she was Prime Minister, so I think we could assume that she broadly approved of it. And the gist of it is that you'd have to prove you were 18 before you could actually watch porn in the UK, and there were various ways of... of doing this.
We talked about it on the podcast in the past, and I have a wonderful video about it where I break it down with the sex blogger Hannah Witten. I think that she is a prime minister defined by lovely intentions and zero execution. So actually, I think when you listen to her speech, that first speech when she walked into Number 10, about the burning injustices, the fact that she talked about lack of access to education, increased kind of like injustices of people of colour, lack of opportunity for women and minorities, that's all stuff that I can technically get behind. And also a lot of stuff that she's trying to kind of like power through in these last few weeks as well. Like she's promised more money to go towards tackling modern slavery, which was a big thing that she wanted to change when she was Home Secretary as well. And that can kind of perhaps to a certain extent be her legacy. But she's just not been able to do anything. And actually even her Brexit approach, although executed appallingly, I think we can all agree with that. There was, when she said that she was stepping down, the way that she talked about compromise and the need to compromise, and actually the fact that she, as when you go into a negotiation, the whole point of a negotiation is that you don't get everything that you ask for. Otherwise, frankly, you've not negotiated well enough. If you go into a negotiation and you get everything you've asked for, like...
You haven't negotiated.
Yeah, you haven't negotiated. They've gone, yeah, all right, mate. And there was this intent, and maybe it wasn't an intent, I think she was humbled hugely by the loss of seats at the election that she called, and that will be seen as one of the big errors that she made as Prime Minister. But she then kind of like... and too late, but she then had to try and like reach across the aisle, talk to the ERG, the hardcore Brexiters, and then talk to like the more Remainy folk in her party. She even had tried to have meetings with Jeremy Corbyn, which, to be frank, were never going to be incredibly fruitful. But I think that there were some good intentions there, and she just... like for a variety of reasons, also because I think from what you hear about her personality isn't necessarily conducive to doing good backdoor politics. She just wasn't able to galvanise people. But she'll be Boris Johnson, if he gets in, is going to be a lovely juxtaposition.
But I think that Theresa May's, you know, failure as Prime Minister have been so substantial that Boris Johnson actually stands a pretty good chance of doing better than her.
Better?
Yeah. Because I her main policy, you know, we obviously haven't left the EU, so in straightforward terms, she failed to deliver Brexit, to use the phrase. But yeah, you alluded to her timetabling in terms of calling a general election and then, you know, flopping it. Partly because of her own inadequacies as a campaigner, and partly because of the U-turn around the social care policy. The idea being that when older people sort of fell sick with things like dementia, that you would sort of potentially sell off their assets, including their home, in order to pay for that social care. So the idea was actually to transfer the costs of aging to richer older people to some degree. And because she got totally savaged by the right-wing press for that policy, she decided to withdraw that policy, and then curiously wouldn't actually admit that anything had changed. That's where the quote "nothing has changed" comes from in relation to Theresa May. But yet she was just really inadequate in terms of actually knowing what she wanted in the first place as far as negotiations go. Triggering Article 50 before she knew what was happening, and therefore starting those negotiations, calling a general election after triggering Article 50, not only wasting time but ultimately losing her House of Commons majority, and then before being unable to deliver, you know, her policy through the House of Commons and actually put her withdrawal agreement through the House of Commons. I mean, I don't want to be too hyperbolic about this, but it has been catastrophic. I think her strategy around Brexit has been utterly rubbish. You know, whatever you wanted from Brexit, you know, if you wanted, you know, Remain to happen ultimately, if you wanted a soft Brexit, if you wanted a hard Brexit, it has just been totally inadequate, really.
I think that it's interesting having the difference between her and Boris. And obviously we're like pontificating into the future and what the hell do we know? But I think that she will be defined by lack of action and paralysis. And Boris Johnson is perhaps going to be defined by action with negative consequences.
Yeah, quite possibly.
And maybe actually we will look back and... I'm not the first person to suggest this, but maybe depending on what happens with No Deal or another pop at the negotiation for a deal, maybe we'll look back at Theresa May and we will have empathy for her and feel sorry for her and see that and see the vision that she tried to put forward with like Brexit and with like her legacy, and we will just see the politics of the time not being able to accommodate that.
Yeah, I mean, what you've just said there, sort of something did strike me about her ability to survive was actually quite impressive. Particularly
after, man, Teflon lady.
Particularly after the general election, it was widely assumed that she would go. And she, if you read accounts of the time, it did sound as though she was considering resigning, but she decided to soldier on almost for another 2 years in the end. And, you know, it was often said that whatever you thought about her lack of charisma, there was something admirable about her doggedness and her willingness to keep going. And I think charisma is actually is pretty overrated as a quality in a politician. Obviously, you need it to some degree, but charisma can often hide a wealth of flaws. See Boris Johnson.
See the man. Yeah, the man who's about to get the job.
And also, like, the doggedness point. I mean, I think it would have been totally reasonable for her to resign after losing that general election. And it's obviously sort of silly to speculate what would have happened, because you don't know who would have ended up as prime minister. But it's hard to believe we'd have been in any worse situation then, with her resigning and there being another leader put in place, perhaps after another general election, than where we are now, which is, you know, we've actually passed the 2 year negotiation limit, we've had an extension, and we don't really seem any further forward than we were back then, to be honest with you. So I think she might have done a lot of good by going sooner and not just hanging on.
You know what I'm really, really excited about, though, and this is the sad thing about me. You know how excited I get about a reshuffle, because it's basically like Top Trumps, but for political nerds. I am so excited about seeing who Boris Johnson puts in his cabinet.
So who are your predictions then?
Oh, for goodness sake, you... What, me? Make a prediction? No, never, I couldn't possibly. Right. I think this was on the front page of the Times, of the Sunday Times today, suggesting that Priti Patel would be Home Secretary. I think that Sajid Javid is actually more likely to stay in that role. What is going to be so interesting is who ends up getting the chancellorship. And I cannot wait for the wide-eyed libertarian optimism of Liz Truss to come crashing into that position. Like, that's going to be super, super fun. I think we'll be... he knows about political theatre, to Tsar Boris, and he'll love to get some praise on his first few days. And I think we may actually end up seeing a large number of like diverse candidates from the women in the Conservative benches, and also from people of colour as well. Perhaps we'll see. It'll be interesting. I don't know.
So other than Sajid Javid, Priti Patel and Liz Truss, is there anyone else you're thinking of in relation to the kind of diversity angle?
Gove.
Is Gove diverse?
Gove is really, really diverse because everyone hates him.
I mean, this is one of the funny things about Gove is I think people often assume that he's a bit of a posho, but he was actually adopted when he was a kid, and he's also Scottish.
He has a really, really interesting story.
His backstory is much more interesting than I think his reputation would suggest. But it's one of those things, actually. If you're a white man, you're never considered as like a diversity candidate, even if you've actually had quite a hard upbringing. in some instances.
Yeah. He's also apparently had a lot more cocaine up his nose than anybody else, so another diverse trait.
I'm not sure that is that diverse in Westminster. not that I want to cast any aspersions, but...
Do you think... One thing before we leave. What if Jeremy Hunt gets in?
It just won't happen. if he did get in, hypothetically, I'm sure I said this on a previous podcast, but he's just not policy-wise, and also in terms of his positioning in the party, I don't think he's different enough from Theresa May to actually affect any substantial change. And I think it's good that Boris Johnson's getting in, if only for the reason that he is actually a proper Leave campaigner. And it does mean that, you know, you'd hope that he'd have more influence with the ERG and with the headbangers than Theresa May had, because she was a Remainer ultimately, albeit not a very enthusiastic one. And I don't think anything would particularly change with Jeremy Hunt in charge. And I think you'd probably end up in a general election in fairly short order as well.
I agree. If I game theory this, I actually think that Boris Johnson is the most likely one out of those two to have us ending up remaining in the European Union.
On the basis that...
We'll talk about that on another podcast.
So
make sure you subscribe! What?
Okay, where can they find you, Jazza, if they want to berate you for leaving them with that excitement unfulfilled?
Yeah. And also, please feel free to berate me for that Scottish accent at the beginning. I am so sorry. You can find me at Jazza John across all social media.
All social media?
Yeah. All 100%. Of it.
Instagram, Facebook, Twitter.
All of it.
There are other social medias. You can find me at JDE Nichols, only on Twitter. Only available on Twitter. I keep my good stuff for there. Twitter exclusive, right, JDE Nichols. And you could also tweet the podcast at Right Dishonor. You can go on the website, rightdishonorable.com. And you can go to patreon.com/rightdishonorable if you want to throw some money at us as well. That's also an option. Always an option.
Cool. Bye.
Bye.